Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Tamal Krishna Goswami Iti Namine Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschatya Desha Sarine Omagyana Chimirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Mukham Kuroti Vachalam Bhagum Lam Gayate Girim Yat Pripadamaham Vande Shri Gurum Vinatarinam Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Narayanam Namaskritya Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Tato Jayamudiraye So today we are beginning a new chapter, chapter 4, entitled The Four Categories of Universal Annihilation. So we're doing text 1. Shri Sukha Uvacha Kalas Te Parama Anu Adhi Dwi Pada Ardha Abhadhi Nripa Katita Yugamanam Cha Shrinu Kalpa Layo Api Shri Sukha Uvacha Kalaste Paraman Bhadhir Kalaste Paraman Bhadhir Dwi paradhavadhi nripa Dwi paradhavadhi nripa Katito yugamanam cha Katito yugamanam cha Shrinu kalpa layavapi Shrinu kalpa layavapi Shri Sukha Uvacha Shri Sukadev Goswami said Kala time Te to you Parama Anu The smallest fraction of time, measured in terms of the invisible atom. Adi, beginning with Dwi Pada Ardha, the two halves of Brahma's total lifespan. Avadhi, culminating in Nripa, O King Parikshit, Katita, has been described. Yugamanam, the duration of the millennia. Cha, and Shrinu, now here. Kalpa, Brahma's day. Layo, annihilation. Api, also. Translation. Sukadev Goswami said, My dear King, I have already described to you the measurements of time beginning from the smallest fraction, measured by the movement of a single atom, up to the total lifespan of Brahma. I have also discussed the measurement of the different millennia of universal history. Now, hear about the time of Brahma's day and the process of annihilation. We'll do text 2. Chatur yugam sahasram tu ramano dinam uchyate sakalpo yatra manavas chatur dasa visham pate. Translation: 1,000 cycles of 4 ages constitute a single day of Brahma, known as a kalpa. In that period, O king, 14 manus come and go. Text number 3. Tadante pralaya sthavan brahmi ratri udharita trayo loka ime tatra kalpante pralaya yahi. After one day of Brahma, annihilation occurs during his night, which is of the same duration. At that time, all the three planetary systems are subject to destruction. Eshanai mitika prokta pralayo yatra vishvasrik sete nantasano vishvam atmasat kritya chatmabhu. This is called the Naimitika, or occasional annihilation, during which the original creator, Lord Narayana, lies down upon the bed of Anantashesha and absorbs the entire universe within himself while Lord Brahma sleeps. So, as this chapter will tell us, there are 4 categories of destruction, and as Sukadeva Goswami tells us in the first verse, he has already described the measurements of time beginning from the atom. There's a chapter in Canto 3, Measurement of Time from the Atom. So that's what's being referred to here. Up until the lifespan of Lord Brahma, which is also in Canto 3, following on from that chapter. And as he says, I have also discussed the measurement of the different millennia of universal history, which is also in the same Canto 3. And now, hear about Brahma's day and the process of annihilation. So in Canto 3, who was speaking? Was it Maitreya Rishi? Sorry? Was it? Yes. So Sukadeva Goswami was relating a conversation between Maitreya Rishi and Vidhura, and in the course of their conversation, Maitreya Rishi is describing the smallest point of time, which is the movement of the atom, up until Lord Brahma's life, which is a long time, a very long time. Lord Brahma's life, if I remember correctly, is something like, what is it? 300 trillion and 40 billion years. Sorry? Say again? 311 trillion and 40 billion years. That's Lord Brahma's life. Try telling that to someone whom you meet on the street, and they won't be taking you very seriously. But that's the sequence or the span of time given within our Puranas, the Bhagavatam among them. And of
course, Purana itself means old or ancient. So Puranas are compilations of ancient histories, ancient accounts of not only the earthly planet, but the other planets of the universe, within the universe also. Not only of human species, but also of devas and demons and so many other species of life that are living on the various other planets within the universe. And of course, this is very different to the account that we are learning, that we learn in school. The account that we learn in school is there is only life on the earthly planet. There's not really much of a concept of life on other planets. Although sometimes, of course, we hear about UFOs and they're quite popular in the popular imagination. But you don't learn about UFOs in school, that we read in the popular literature. But in our education that is received in Western countries, then life is only accepted to be existent on the earthly planet, and that evolved over, you know, some millions of years. And then to tell them there's a creator of the universe who lives for 311 trillion and 40 billion years, there's a lot of convincing to do. There would be a lot of convincing to do. And then to tell them on top of that, that there's life on other planets, there would also be a lot of convincing to do. Even to tell them life on this earthly planet, civilized, you know, human life on this earthly planet is some millions and millions of years, that also even will take a lot of convincing to do. So we have a very different worldview, not only in the spiritual context, but even in the material context. Our teachings, our scriptures have a very different worldview. Even Christianity, they rate the history of the earth as more or less 5,000-6,000 years. That was when God created in 7 days. And then from God's rib came Adam, and then from his other rib came Eve. And that was only 5,000, 6,000 years ago. That's there, as far back as they are willing to go to acknowledge that that's the age of the earth. Creation, not only the earth, but creation generally. Modern science, of course, goes back millions of years earlier, but they have the whole theory of evolution, how life gradually evolved from some one-celled amoebas to become a combination, and then it gradually becomes a fish, and then the fish decide to walk on land, and over millions of years they develop feet so they can walk on land. Then they decide to climb in the trees, and over millions of years they develop the ability to climb in trees. Then they decide to stand up straight, and then over another millions of years they become something resembling human beings. And then at some point in all of this, they develop a brain, and with that brain then they develop cities and cultures and literatures and religions and so on and so forth. And this also takes, you know, some thousands of years to happen. So this is the story we are told or taught. And if we compare the two, of course, in one sense, the Bhagavatam account of life and creation, in one context, it's also hard to believe, given our background. I mean, think of it. If you think of Mahavishnu lying down in the causal ocean, you know, and he's, how big is he? And then from the pores of his skin, you have universes emanating. I mean, in one way, it is hard to accept. And then within all of these universes, the Lord expands as Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, and then from his navel you have a lotus flower. And then on top of the lotus flower, then this four-headed creature, this four-headed human being appears on this lotus flower, top of the lotus flower. And then he begins to create the varieties of living beings within the universe. So certainly it's in one way it is difficult to accept. We have to accept it on faith, because we're not going to find any archaeological evidence of Lord Brahma or Mahavishnu or anybody like that. So we have to accept it on faith. Really, that is the only way to accept the accounts. Some of the accounts given in the Puranas is based upon our faith. But at the same time, if we read the story of modern science about the sequence of creation, it's also no less believable, actually. When you think of it, and you read of how everything gradually evolved, first from a big bang, then from some, and that all turned around over millions of years, and then it gelled into planets, and it gelled into this and that, and then, you know, the amoebas, and if we read that whole sequence, it's also no less believable. If we compare, you know, if we were a neutral party, putting the two on a scale, of course, because we're devotees, we have faith, so naturally, we will accept the account of our scriptures, naturally, as being more valid than what we read in the science literature. But as a neutral observer, I would think, if we put the two on a scale, both of them are quite, in one context, unbelievable. One is not necessarily more believable than the other. Even though science, of course, prides itself as having experimented and tested and hypothesized and etc., theorizing, and they feel they have an airtight explanation for how creation and how life came to be. But really, it's really no more believable than what we read in the Puranas. It's just as fantastic. I mean, when you think of it, an amoeba over millions of years deciding to become a fish. I mean, it is quite mystical. And then when you think that fish, over millions of years, you know, finds itself on the land and over millions of years needs to do something on the land, and therefore it develops feet, 4 feet at that, and then it begins to walk on land. Then you have our lizards and so on. And then these lizards, you know, at some reason or another, they find, you know, they need to climb on trees to protect themselves from predators, and they develop arms, and they, you know, they stand up a bit. Instead of lying flat, they're kind of standing up a bit. I mean, it's really quite mystical when we think of how the sequence occurs. And our Bhagavatam account is no less, in one sense, it's no less mythical, comparatively speaking. The point I would like to make is, enough science is not more believable than the Puranic accounts, even though it has this reputation somehow as being able to has an airtight explanation backed up by evidence and all these other sorts of things. But really, there's not much going for it. So it's no more believable than our Puranic descriptions of creation, of the world, and so on and so forth. It's also a belief, and of course, nowadays also, it's not uncommon to hear, you know, people say, or some people say, that science is simply another religion. It has its dogma, and if anybody objects, and then, you know, the scientists or the priests of the dogma, they argue it endlessly, and if somebody doesn't accept it, or if it's questioned, then, you know, you're a heretic in a different context, as it was, you know, some hundreds of years ago, at least in Europe. Anyway. And that's, of course, the Western worldview, Christianity and so on, is the Western worldview. But we, in our Puranic accounts, of course, time is very cyclical. Even in religious traditions from the West, there's one beginning and there's one end. And there's one life. We have one birth and one death. And then even the materialistic version, there's one beginning and there's one end, and that evolves over some however many millions and trillions of years. But our Puranic accounts, everything is cyclical. It goes around in circles. We have many births and many deaths. There are many creations and many destructions. And this chapter, the four categories of annihilation, one of the categories, which will be described later, is the constant creation and destruction that occurs every day. Every day there's creation and destruction going on endlessly. It's an endless cycle. The insects, during insect season, you know, they're at night, they're all buzzing around the lights, and the next morning they're dead. So there's this endless cycle of creation and destruction. And this is one of the categories of universal annihilation. And that we can all visibly see every day of our life. There's creation going on and destruction going on. And then in this verse 2 and 3, Sukadeva Goswami is describing another category of annihilation, which happens at the end of Lord Brahma's day. And therefore it's occasional. It happens regularly. Naimittika. Naimittika means occasional annihilation. Happens every day in Lord Brahma's day. At the end of his day, then, as it says, Lord Narayan, as Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, is, as we know, lying down on Lord Anantashesh, and the entire universe is... The universe itself is still there. The shell of the universe is still there. But everything within the universe is... enters into the body of Mahavishnu while Lord Brahma sleeps. And then when Mahavishnu wakes up, not wakes up as such as we're waking up, but when day arises, then everything automatically appears from the body of Mahavishnu. Sometimes it's also described that the three worlds, of course we have the Bhur, Bhuva and Swa, the earthly, heavenly, and then the planets of the sages and rishis. Sometimes it's described that at the end of Lord Brahma's day, then the flood waters, the details will come in later verses here, but the water from the Garbhadak ocean rises and floods the universe. And it says sometimes the sages, they go to Lord Brahma's planet where they hang out with Lord Brahma, for want of a better word, sorry, where they stay with Lord Brahma during the course of his evening. And then of course morning begins, the waters recede and the varieties of species and so on are created. That is called Vikalpa. Sorry, not Vikalpa, Visharga. Sharga means the original creation of the total material cosmos is known as Sharga. That's one category of creation. And then one category of destruction is when this same total material creation is completely destroyed. That's when everything enters into the body of Mahavishnu. So we have the creation of Mahavishnu, which is known as Sarga. He creates the total material cosmos. And then at the end, you've all heard when Mahavishnu breathes out, right? You've all heard that, John? You've heard that part before? When Mahavishnu breathes out, then in the process of that breathing out, then the whole material cosmos is created, the material energy becomes manifest, the souls are impregnated within the material energy, and then everything, you know, begins to categorize itself as the different material elements. So that's Sharga. And then when Mahavishnu breathes in, then that whole process is simply reversed. It goes backwards. And that is called, that's the final annihilation. That's one category of annihilation. And then we have this Visharga, which is described also in the third canto and the second canto. in which at the end, at the beginning of Lord Brahma's day, there is a partial creation. And then when his night comes, then there is also a partial destruction. And that partial, in that, when Lord Brahma goes, when his evening comes and he shuts down, then the universe itself is not destroyed, but everything within the universe is. So that's a partial annihilation. That's another category. So we have the main category of creation, the main creation, and then the main destruction. And then in between that main creation and the main destruction, we have three other destructions. One, as we just mentioned, is the constant creation and destruction that goes on every day, every moment. That's endless. It just goes on and on and on. And then another category is the, at the end of Lord Brahma's evening, as it is said, when the universe itself is not destroyed, but all the varieties of species and so on within the universe is destroyed. So that's another category. And then when Lord Brahma wakes up, then he creates again. And that is called Visarga, recreation. That's called Visarga. And then, as we also read in text 2, Sukadeva Goswami says that one, we all know what the four ages are. So times 1,000, that's Lord Brahma's day. And then the same amount of time is his evening. And during that time, we have 14 Manus come and go. So who are the Manus? They are the progenitors of human beings. And during Lord Brahma's one day, there are 14 of them. So that generally that's said to be 72 cycles of the four ages. We have the four ages times 72 cycles. That's the time period of a Manu. And they're the progenitors of the human beings, progenitors of humanity. And after that sequence, then the whole management of the universe undergoes a change. The various devas in the heavens, most of them undergo a complete change. So at the end of the period of Manu, there's also another annihilation, partial, not a very large one. At the end of Brahma's day, most of the planetary systems are destroyed. At the end of the period of Manu, we just have the earthly planetary system is destroyed, and sometimes a bit higher, but mostly just the earthly planetary system is destroyed. And the major devas, the administrators of the universe, during that same time, then they undergo a complete change of government, basically. That's what it is. It's just more or less a complete change of government. Of course, some of the devas, they remain for the whole lifetime of Lord Brahma, like Lord Brahma himself, for example. He remains for his whole lifetime. And of course, devas like Yamaraj, and of course Lord Shiva and Ganesh and so on, they remain for the whole lifetime of Lord Brahma. But the other less prominent devas, like Indra, the king of heaven, and his whole entourage of devas, they all change with the period of Manu. So, and that annihilation, more or less, is just the earthly planet, and sometimes a bit higher. So these are the four categories. The end, the final annihilation, when Mahavishnu breathes everything within, the annihilation, and that's complete, that's total, everything's gone. And then at the end of Lord Brahma's day, there's a partial annihilation within the universe. Then at the end of the period of Manu, there's an annihilation, but it's even smaller. And then, of course, the constant annihilation that's going on, you know, every day, basically. So simply put, these are the four categories. And what we have read today is one of them, maybe two, if we include the manus. I don't remember if it's described in more detail later in the chapter, but these are the four, the two categories of annihilation that we have covered, and this goes on endlessly, because Eastern traditions, including Buddhism, they have this cyclical understanding of time. There's many creations, many destructions, many births, many deaths, and it makes more sense, I think, anyway. Of course, we're all biased, naturally, because we have faith in our scriptures, so naturally we're going to be biased. But it makes more sense, particularly from a spiritual perspective, because if we consider that we are spiritual beings encased in a material body, then we would like to think we would have more chance than one to achieve perfection. Because if we're not spiritual beings, if we're just an evolvement of chemicals and so on, then it doesn't really matter, because there's no other purpose. When you're dead, you're dead. That's it. There's nothing else to worry about. But if we consider that we are spiritual beings, and of course we will accept we are spiritual beings, encased, in this material dress, then we would like to think, I would like to think, that I have more than one chance. And therefore, the idea of reincarnation certainly is more appealing. It certainly is more appealing in Christianity and the other Western traditions. You just have one life. You just have one chance. And that's not very encouraging, somehow. And then after your one chance, you're left in an ozone land until the end of times. And then somebody comes along and decides if you're going to hell forever or if you're going to heaven forever. And if you're going to hell forever, that's it. That's your chance. You have one chance, and then you're in an ozone layer for however long, until the end of times. And then, all loving God comes along and decides if you're going to heaven or hell. And if you're going to hell, as far as I understand it, then that's it. You don't have much of a chance to go anywhere else after that. So it's not very appealing. But in our Vedic tradition, teachings from the Puranas and the Vedas, and of course we're eternal spiritual beings, and we have many opportunities to perfect ourselves spiritually. Not only that, but we have many opportunities to fulfill our material inclinations also. We have many opportunities to fulfill our material inclinations by taking body after body in all different varieties. And it goes on, endlessly. As it is said, as we said in the beginning, Lord Brahma's life is 311 trillion and 40 billion years. That's a very long time. And to think that we have gone through this cycle a number of times. It's a very long time. But it all passes very quickly. It all appears to pass very quickly anyway. And when we return to the spiritual realm, then in spite of this, apparently unlimited frame of time, it's almost like, oh, where did you go? It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything, because in the spiritual world everything is in the present. There's not exactly a past as such, and nor is there a future as such. It's all in the present. So upon returning to the spiritual world, then we, it's really like we never left, actually, considering. Because comparatively speaking, the material existence is just, it has no meaning. It really has no meaning. But because it appears to be so long, therefore we are said to be eternally conditioned. But upon returning there, that, eternally conditioned has no meaning whatsoever. And the sense of time, it's like we turned our head and then we turned around again. That's all it is. We turned away from Krishna for some moments and then we turn towards him again. So returning to the spiritual world is leaving the spiritual world is turning away. Going back is it just really in the absolute sense that's the experience. But having said that, certainly there's a long time that we have to be in this. It has been a long time that we had to have been in this material world. And when we, you know, reflect upon the length of all of this, then it also helps one, helps us to not get so uptight about existence in the material world. I mean, what, we live for 60, 70 years, 80 years, you know, if we're lucky, and it maybe seems like a long time. But we consider it in the larger scale. I mean, what is 80 years? It really is nothing. It doesn't mean anything. It seems that we experience so many things during that 80 years, and some of those experiences are very gut-wrenching or heart-wrenching. And you know, that those experiences sometimes transform the way we think and feel and behave and etc. But when we consider it in the larger scale of things, in the larger picture, what does it mean? It really means nothing. We're eternal beings. And the little blips, you know, the blips that we go through in our different lives. I mean, even in, we live for 80 years, you know, we go through some crisis when we're 20. By the time we're 30, it doesn't mean much. In a lot of cases, of course, sometimes it does, it carries on. But we go through some crisis when we're 20. By the time we're 30, what does it mean? We're basically forgotten about it. Or it might be there, but we don't dwell on it. And we just get on with things. Of course, at the time, it seems like the whole world is going to come crumbling down. But after some time has passed, then it really it has very little consequence for us. And then we think, you know, then again, when we're 50 or 60, you know, things that we experienced when we were 20 or 30 don't have much meaning. You know, the thing that turned us upside down when we were 20, when we're 40, we probably laugh about it. We think, my God, that was ridiculous, wasn't it? And then we, that's in within our one lifetime. And then we think, you know, over 4, 5, 6, you know, 100,000, 1,000,000 lifetimes. What does it mean? It really doesn't mean very much at all. But due to our conditioning and due to our attachment to things of this material world, we take ourselves so seriously, too seriously, and we take our experiences too seriously. But when we consider eternity, the non-permanence, you know, of everything that we experience in the material world, then it helps, can help anyway, it can help cultivate detachment. You know, sometimes people ask, well, you know, people ask, well, if we had past lives, why can't we remember them? I should be able to remember them. But do you really want to remember your past lives? I mean, a lot of things in this life we prefer to forget. There's a lot of experiences in this life we prefer to forget. And then do we want to remember our past lives? And it's quite unusual, quite often, when, if you may have seen documentaries and this and that, when we read or hear about people's supposed past lives, quite often they're always something good. Have you noticed that? You never get an instance of somebody being a cat or a dog or a beggar or something like that. They were always, you know, doing something. They were some prince or princess or some rich guy or girl. They were always something more, you know, 200, 300 years ago. But you don't, I haven't read or heard anyway of when people supposedly remember their past lives, that they were some beggar, you know, in the streets of Calcutta struggling for food. You don't read of such past life memories. And one reason certainly is because people block them out. Because they're so stressful. They were obviously, you know, stressful sequence of events in, you know, their multi-life existence. And what the mind just blocks them out and just throws it, you know, way back in the subconscious. So we don't want to remember our past life. And who cares anyway if we were, you know, Louis the 14th or something, you know, who cares? I remember reading, this was some years ago, was it Newsweek? You know, it's our international news magazine. And one of their pages, they have different quotes or statements from politicians or artists or whatever, you know, just some short one sentence thing. And there was one statement from a New Age tour guide for the pyramids in Egypt. Of course, they have all these theories how it's all sorts of things. You know, landing path for the UFOs and all other such stuff. So, and he was a New Age tour guide for the pyramids, and he was taking all these, you know, New Age people there. And he said, "I've met so many Cleopatras, I'm having problems understanding who's the real one." So they have all these, you know, supposed visions of who they were in the past. And whether it's true, whether somebody was Cleopatra or not, and what does it matter? Now we're, you know, whoever we are is what we are. Which is why Prabhupada so often, when devotees would, you know, question him, well, where did we come from? Did we come from the spiritual world or did we come from somewhere else? Sometimes devotees would probe him. And he would offer some answers, and then at some point he would say, anyway, it doesn't matter. Now you're here. And you're struggling in this material world, in the ocean of birth and death. I mean, in a one sense, it doesn't matter whether you came from Krishna Loka or Vaikuntha or Brahmajyoti or wherever it is. Now you're entangled in the material world. Just get out. Then you can, then we can, you know, figure out where we're coming from. And of course, he gave the example, if we're drowning in the ocean, and then somebody throws us a rope, we don't, you know, begin to reflect and philosophize. So how did I get here? We grab the rope and take advantage of the rope and, you know, get pulled out. And that is, you know, the purpose. One of the purposes of our practice of Krishna consciousness is to break out of this endless cycle of, you know, birth and death. To break out of this endless cycle of birth and death. So we don't have to go on and on and on, you know, experiencing the things that we have experienced already countless number of times. We've already experienced what we have experienced countless number of times in all sorts of species. And if we reflect upon this, then it helps us, can help us to not take ourselves so seriously, not take our situation so seriously, and to develop a degree of detachment. But that alone will not break us from the cycle of birth and death. In order to relieve ourselves from the cycle of birth and death, then we need to, of course, attach ourselves to Krishna, be attached to Krishna, and everything related to Krishna, the path of devotional service and chanting and hearing and remembering and so on. Because really it's that attachment to Krishna that will pull us out of the material world. Detachment won't. It may make life more bearable whilst we're here, but it's only attaching ourselves to Krishna that will pull us out of the material world. And that is, that's part of the purpose of Sukadeva Goswami describing this whole sequence of creation and destruction. So I'll finish. Are there any questions or comments? How do we attach ourselves to Krishna? That's an easy one. What did Mataji say yesterday? Chanting Hare Krishna. That is the primary method of attaching ourselves to Krishna. Because what's separating us from Krishna is our ego, our material desires, attachments. This is the gap between us and Krishna. Therefore, we have this experience of separation. But as we know, the chanting of Hare Krishna removes that covering. And when that covering is removed, then naturally the magnetic force of the soul towards Krishna is realized. And then naturally we become more and more attached to Krishna as that material covering is removed. And of course, obviously, service. Why do we serve anyone? Because we're attached to them. So by serving Krishna, then naturally we will become attached. And by hearing about him, of course, not just chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, but by hearing how Krishna is such a wonderful person, how he deals with his devotees, how he has so many wonderful qualities. By hearing about a wonderful person, naturally we become attached to them and we want to meet them. Oh, I wouldn't mind meeting that person. No, we hear about so-and-so devotee wherever, so-and-so Swami. Oh, they give really good classes. Oh, they can lead kirtan really nicely. And we develop a desire within, oh, I would like to meet them. Oh, I'd like to hear their class. Oh, I would like to attend their kirtan. So in the same way, we want to hear about Krishna. How he is such a wonderful person, how he's so kind, he's so loving, and etc. And by hearing about him in that manner, then naturally we will develop a stronger and stronger desire to want to meet him. And that attachment to meet him will grow and become stronger and stronger, and then there we go. We meet him. Then you get a big hug like Gopa Kumar. There's this story you may have heard in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita of one devotee who began in Vrindavan village as a cowherd boy. And the story traces him, his journey, wanting to meet Krishna. And, I mean, he took a long time. You know, from a cowherd boy, he became a king on the earth, and he became the king. Then he moved into heaven to figure, you know, to see what was going on there. Then he moved to Brahmaloka to see what was going on there. Then he went to Shivaloka to see what was going on there. Then he went to Vaikuntha to see what was going on there. Then he passed through Ayodhya, Dwarka. He went to all these places trying to meet Krishna, thinking, is Krishna here? Is he there? Is he there? And he went to each place and he saw, well, Krishna's not here. Somebody's there. But Krishna is not there. And then eventually he goes back to Goloka Vrindavan. And it was just like it was described. This was Krishna was coming back from herding the cows in the evening, and then he sees Gopa Kumar and gives him a big hug. Where were you? So that's what happens. That's what happens for every devotee. Because he was a cowherd boy, so he got a hug in that sense, but it might be different for other moods of service. But that's what happens. Yes, Nanda.
Probably you mentioned that Christianity describes that creation took place 5,000-6,000 years ago, entire material world. Now that is contradictory to Vedic literature.
Yes.
Sainikic claims.
Yes. I think Prabhupada said so. We can't consider it a bona fide religion in the context that it teaches people to love God and to surrender to God. It may not give, you know, a technically correct description of creation as such, but it's bona fide religion in the sense that it gives people a concept of God and worshipping God and surrendering to God and so on. So in that context, certainly, yes. But it doesn't give a technically correct description of the creation. It gives a concept of the creation, but it doesn't give a technically correct description of the creation as such. So that doesn't disqualify it from being a bona fide religious path. And some Christians will argue that. They'll say the Bible is a spiritual text, not a creation text. So can't expect to find the details of creation in the Bible, because they would just say we go there for spiritual guidance, not for information about the creation of the world. Casper, yeah. Dinosaurs, yes. Well, I haven't read much about dinosaurs, but I have only heard that they're from a previous Kali Yuga. That's all that I've heard about them. What's so funny? Sorry?
End of our Kali Yuga, they might be.
Possibly, yeah. It could even happen at the end of this Kali Yuga. There's no reason to think that they weren't dinosaurs, that such creatures were existent. It's not hard to believe, to accept that such things existed. You read about all sorts of strange creatures, you know. In the Puranas also, you read about all sorts of strange creatures with... Yes, yes. We would say that, yes. Scientists wouldn't say that, of course. Well, that depends who you ask. That's what science will say. The people who believe in the theory of evolution, they will say dinosaur fossils are however many millions of years, and human beings as we know them now, they're only 40 or 50,000 years old. But there are fossils, apparently, that have been found, that have been dated back millions of years also. But because it didn't fit the theory, they were not considered. So there is that information is also there. Fossils. Human fossils that go back millions of years. But because they didn't accept the theory, they were just sidelined. There is information like that also. But minus all of that, whether there's fossils or not fossils, there's not a lot of fossils anyway. I mean, World War II was how long ago? Yeah, it's 60 years. What remnants of that will you find in Europe now? I mean, how many thousands of tanks, human beings, planes? You know, thousands and thousands of that stuff was all over Europe at some point in time. You go there now, you don't see anything. And that's just 60 years. And then if you think of it, you know, fossils going back millions of years, I mean, how is a few fossils, even if it's true that only human fossils going back 40,000 years, why should we take that as telling our whole story of existence? And there's not many fossils anyway. But why should those few fossils decide the whole story of humanity? I don't think it's very sensible, but anyway. Even 100 years ago, there's no remnants of World War II. A few tanks here and there, perhaps, that they keep on... Yes, I'm not disagreeing with dinosaur fossils. Well, there certainly are some. Even 50,000 years ago fossils, there's not many. There's not many. It's not like there's millions of, you know, fossils from 50,000 years ago either. There's only a handful. There's only a handful. And then based upon those handful, they draw a whole picture of human origins. But that's what I was saying. That's the big difference between our Puranic account of creation, history, and life. It's very different. It's diametrically opposite to what we read in our science books. It's different. The same people will say there's only life on Earth. Do you believe that? Well, that they will also say that. There's only life on Earth. They don't accept there's UFOs and life on other planets or anything. Yeah, but they're the radical. They're the radical fringe. They're the radical fringe. And within the evolution theory, there's also a radical fringe that accept and have supposedly found human fossils going back millions of years also. Yeah, I know. I accept. I agree that it does go both ways. Yeah, I understand that. I understand that. Then you should read Hidden History of the Human Race. And I'll give you a website. You can go on that and read that also. The same people who say human beings only went 40, 50,000 years ago, they're the same people who say there's no God. They're the same people who say there isn't life on other planets. And they're the same people who will say religion is a construct of human beings to describe features of nature. The same people will say all of those things. So, point being, we pick and choose, naturally, we pick and choose. But the same people say all of that. According to them, you know, Krishna didn't exist. You know, he's just some made up figure that people like to worship. So they say all these things also. They say all these things also. But anyway, if you can read that Hidden History of the Human Race, but nobody has it here. Sorry? Search for Vedic India. Yeah. Then I'll give you a couple of websites. If you do website searching, then you can just have a read and see what you like. Yes, Mahdi. I haven't. Again, the only thing that I heard was he didn't comment so much about fossils generally. And what I heard about dinosaurs, I don't know if he said it or it's just something that we have heard, that they're from a previous Kali Yuga or something to that extent. I haven't heard anything further. He didn't comment in much detail that I'm aware of anyway. Thank you. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.